Welcome to the Cycling in Alignment podcast, an examination of cycling as a practice and dialogue about the integration of sport in right relationship to your life.
Greetings, space monkeys. Did you know that you can go to my website, colbypierce.com, and book an integrative bicycle fitting? What is an integrative bicycle fitting, you ask? And why didn't you just call it a bike fit, Pierce? Well, allow me to explain. An integrative bicycle fitting is a unique product that achieves a high level of client understanding through examination of holistic movement patterns and systems throughout the body, including muscular, fascial, visceral, neurological, lymphatic, circulatory, respiratory, and limbic systems. These are understood in the context of how the dream, goal, or objective aligns life for the client's choices and habits. The environment, psyche, and drive will result in the current expression of athletic ability. This product was created to serve riders who have not found satisfactory results from conventional fitting methods. By taking time to understand an athlete on a level with more depth, we allow space for change in trajectory, which can bring about healing. Orthodox or conventional bike fitting looks at a rider through a biomechanical lens, understanding the athlete as a system of levers that applies power to the pedals and nothing more. Ostensibly, when the relationship of these levers is optimized, the rider will perform to their potential. If a rider's challenges fall outside the scope of this model, often the problems will go unresolved. By attempting to solve all problems with only biomechanical tools, we are limiting the choices we have to bring the athlete to a higher state of health. We must expand our toolbox and widen the scope of our methods in order to serve the client more completely. Cycling is a battleground which will test you on every level if you go far enough. It will break you down to your nucleus and give you the opportunity to build yourself back up again. It can provide the landscape for your own hero's journey. The integrative bicycle fitting is designed to assist you in this process. A session will take about 6.5 hours and have 4 phases. Phase 1 is observation. We meet at the fit studio and go for a ride of about an hour. During this ride, I will take video footage of you in the real world. Then we will return to the shop for a comprehensive holistic movement assessment and more video taken indoors. Phase 2 is discussion, education, and mapping. In this phase, we discuss what we learned from our video footage and I educate you about your current movement patterns. Then we decide the course of action and discuss recommendations. In the third phase, known as change, we take initial bicycle measurements and we begin to make changes in the contact points of the bike. We also do an off-the-bike movement review, instruction of essential movement practices, cycling technique, and posture on the bike. The final phase, integration, involves the completion of the fit process in which I take final bicycle measurements and we have closing discussion. If you want to read more about my integrative fitting sessions, please visit colbypierce.com, click on services, and then you'll find the link to integrative bicycle fitting. You'll also see a link to my scheduling calendar there. Thank you for listening, and please remember to always think critically, act intuitively, and pedal consciously. Hello there, space monkeys. I'm walking. It's nighttime after dinner, and I thought I'd take a few minutes to talk to you about the importance of walking. Old school cycling had a belief system that walking was bad for you, that the more you spent time on your feet, the worse you would ride. And that if you were standing, you should be sitting. And if you were sitting, you should be lying down. This is a belief system that was cultured and brought about in the old world, as I will heretofore refer to it as. And it was brought about during a time when, first of all, souplesse was more highly valued than it is now. And secondly, it was brought about in a world that glorified or was contained by professional cycling. So people who rode a lot were told to stay off their feet. And this is pretty obvious. If you're riding your bike 25 hours a week or 30 hours a week, then walking around a bunch will just make you more tired. And if your life is that myopically focused on going fast on a bicycle, whether you're getting paid to do it or not, first of all, you didn't have time to do a lot of walking. And secondly, you were riding so much that you needed to sleep more. And third, if you spent time on your feet, it probably meant that you would reduce the capacity for recovery, or maybe simply accumulate more edema in your lower limbs. When you're vertical and you're walking, blood and lymph tend to flow down because, again, unless you're an astronaut or a scuba diver, gravity's just always there. She's relentless. Relentlessly sucking us towards the center of the Earth. Although I'm going to take a moment to be grateful for gravity, because if gravity wasn't here, we would immediately be flung helplessly into space. See Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1. So when we think about the old school model, we can understand that it's taken out of context for a couple of reasons. One is that, well, souplesse was probably overvalued in some respects of the sport. And I can say that as an old guy, I definitely came from that school. When I grew up racing track, it was quite common for us to race in a 92 or 94 inch gear during even national championship level events. And now people are racing in gears that are at least 10 inches bigger than that. But it's not just on the track. It's also on the road. When you purchase a team bike from any World Tour team, if you're so lucky, or if you go to the postseason sales site on EF Education First and you buy a former team bike, it comes with a 54-44 chainring, or 42, something like that. Something obnoxiously large. But the big ring's a 54. So strangely, amateur riders have begun to ride in smaller chain rings. A 52-36 is probably standard for most road bikes these days. And for a gravel bike, a 50-34 is quite common if you're using a double. But World Tour level bikes have gotten bigger chain rings. So does that mean pros have gotten faster? Well, I don't know. There's endless debate about this. No matter what year you look at the Peloton, and no matter what year you interview riders, the races are always faster than they were. So to be honest, I get a little tired of this inflation, race pace inflation. I'm not trying to disrespect anyone who's a pro today. I'm quite sure that all of them can wipe the floor with me. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying that it's sort of human nature to pedestalize the performance you just went through, because the experience was intense. So, you know, we get to see post-race interviews with Geraint Thomas talking about how he can't believe Pogacar's ride at Strada. And, you know, don't get me wrong, it was an impressive ride, but there's also nothing new under the sun. I had a lot of people come up to me and ask me about that ride in the weeks afterwards. And I got to say, it wasn't as impressive to me as it was to other people. And again, I'll humbly offer that I don't mean any disrespect to Pogacar. I mean, this guy doesn't give a shit about me or know me from a hole in the wall, so no skin off his nose. But I see a lot of things that, how do I phrase this? I'll try to choose my words carefully. What impresses me in a person or a rider is growth. And I don't see growth in that ride. I see the same old sword being wielded. And look, that sword is an impressive sword. It won him in the race by a long ways. And it detonated the field and, you know, smashed this, that, or whatever. I don't know. Smashed all the watts. And I think that there's a, say, default perspective in cycling where people want to see a glorious solo winner shred the field, just as Pogacar did in Strada. Just to be confusing, I'm going to alternately refer to him as Pogacar and Pogacar, just to mess with people. So when he did this, we get this beautiful dichotomy of reactions. We have people who are bored by the fact that he won by so much, and they're irritated that the race wasn't closer. And then simultaneously, we have just as many people on the other side of the fence who are fantastically wowed by his dominant performance. And maybe I'm just too jaded or old or something, but I'm just sort of yawn at all of the discussions, and I just watch the races because they are what they are. So, okay, it's a bike race and somebody won. What are the interesting points about it? How did he win? What were his chosen tactics? Were they effective or not effective? Were they lucky or not lucky? What did his position look like on the bike during that 80K solo? I've got a lot of thoughts on that. Maybe I'll share those in some other podcast. But right now we're talking about walking, and I got way off in the weeds. So really what I'm saying is you should walk. You should walk every day. You have to walk every day because walking is the most fundamental biomechanical expression of being a human. It's the basis for how we do everything. What do humans do? We run and walk. How do you get food? You walk from where you are to where the food is. How do you hunt? You walk after the herd of antelope, and maybe you jog, and maybe occasionally you run, although we're the crappiest runners in the animal kingdom by a long ways. How do you talk to that hot chick? You walk over to her. What do you do when you screw up? You run from her. Sorry, bad joke. What do you do? That was more of a slight of men, on men than ladies, by the way, or at least that's how it was intended. How do you get to water? You walk to it. How do you get to the bathroom? You walk to it. You see where I'm going? This is why plantar fasciitis is so devastating, or plantar fasciosis, if we're being technically more correct. Because as it turns out, walking is a thing that's easy to take for granted. And if anyone's listening who's ever had a serious accident or something that challenged their ability to walk, you will know exactly what I'm talking about. When you can't walk, your whole world falls apart. So this old school concept that walking is antithetical to cycling performance is incorrect because it does not ruin your souplesse. It makes you more buoyant and elastic, especially if you do it correctly. It corrects some of the less favorable mover patterns that are propagated by riding a bike. Example, when you walk, if you do it properly, you do go into a small amount of hip extension. What is hip extension? There's that ION word that Ricky was talking about in what will now be one of the past podcasts that you've listened to. That's Ricky Stanzi from GOTA. And an ION word is just an anatomical term. Extension, flexion. Flexion means moving towards the fetal position. There's your happy mnemonic. Flexion equals fetal. And extension means moving away. So when your hip goes into extension, it means your femur opens away from your chest. And when you go into extension, it means it goes past neutral. Neutral is when your femur is in line with your torso, when you're standing with good posture, as an example. So extension is when your knee is behind your torso in standing. This happens at the sort of end of your gait cycle. So as your right foot steps forward, you strike with the heel, then you go through the midfoot, then you push off. If you have functional hips, your foot will be behind your body, your knee will be behind your body. That's hip extension. Tracking? So walking puts you in hip extension. Guess why cycling is just like sitting? Because you're always in hip flexion. This is why cyclists tend to have such tight hips, as a general observation. So walking offsets this. Also, when you walk, you must use minimal shoes. Put your Hokas in the trash and light your Ons on fire. These are garbage. I'm over being polite about those shoes. They're complete shit. Do not wear them. Do not buy them. Foam is evil for the human body, especially for the nervous system, and especially when you walk on it. Don't walk on foam. No foamy shoes, no heel toe drop, no pillows strapped to your feet. You should not wear comfortable shoes. No one should wear comfortable shoes. Your feet are sensory organs. Wake them up. Make them strong. Make them engage with the ground. This is a commandment. I'm doing it again where I say over and over again, I don't like to tell people what to do, but occasionally It just comes out of my mouth. So you must wear minimal shoes. You must walk barefoot. You must touch your feet to the bare earth. You must make strong, stable feet. And the easiest way to do this is to walk. So find your minimal shoes or walk barefoot. If you have a dog, you got a built-in way to do this. 2 times a day, 5 to 15 minutes a day. Ideally once, first thing in the morning. I know Andrew Huberman is a bit controversial at the moment, but he does have some good life advice, although some of it isn't so great. But the parts that we can selectively take are the good parts, right? Not old school, not new school, all school. Take the good parts, leave the crap behind. So, from Huberman's good pile, we wake up, we drink water, we have some salt. I'll modify that a bit further and say, have some sea salt, not table salt. This is important. For me, this is really important. For some people, not so much. Then, if you can, go for a walk. Before you have your coffee. Before you have your breakfast. There's lots of reasons to do these things. They're all science-y and fancy. And you can call it neurobiology or neurochemistry. You can call it circadian rhythms. You can talk about neurotransmitters. We talk about hormone levels. Blah, blah, blah. We can talk about all those things. We can also boil it down to some really practical advice. Wake up with the sun. Drink some water. Have some salt. Go for a walk. Do it in minimal shoes. Or in bare feet. The only rules are, don't freeze, puncture, or burn your feet. And watch out for the dog shit. And here's one I've been doing recently. I'll add to this. When you get home, if you do walk barefoot or you go to a park, wash your feet. We have a very population-dense planet. There are a lot of dogs on our planet. In our neighborhood right now, we have a lot of rabbits. And we don't have a dog currently as a family. We have 2 cats. Our cats are indoor cats for the most part. So that means we have a lot of rabbits in our yard, which means when I go do animal flow, I'm putting my hands and my feet probably in a lot of rabbit shit. Now, I'm not a zoobotanist or a expert on parasites, but if I grind too much of that into my skin, things are likely to go sideways. So the first thing I do when I get inside is I wash off my feet and my hands, the surfaces of my feet and my hands really well, and I use Dr. Bronner's. That's a natural soap in case you didn't know. And if you're wondering why I mentioned that particular brand, please go see my podcast with Ashley Frager on Back to Basics to understand a bit more about why I'm so selective about the soaps I use in my body. So we must walk. And unless you're recording a podcast like I am, or unless you're walking with your spouse or friend and talking, when you walk, you should breathe only through your nose. And when you walk and you transfer your weight head over foot from side to side with a slight swagger in proportion to the intensity upon which you are walking or running, just as on the bike, your head over foot increases with an increase in torque or intensity. Proportionally, you also allow the rotational spiral nature of the human body to take place. You allow that spiral pattern to persist. And this is a very natural pattern in our movement. And this pattern can be disrupted by too much cycling. This is really easy to see when you ask a cyclist to do a simple march test. By this, I mean you just ask them to march in place. Close their eyes and march in place. And if you do it on the spot, a good number of them will march ipsilaterally, which is really incorrect. What does ipsilaterally mean? It means that when your right knee goes up or your right thigh, your right hand goes forward. You want to march contralaterally. When you're running, you don't run with the right arm coming forward as the right leg comes forward. You have a contralateral rotation to the upper body. So as the right leg goes forward, the left arm comes forward, right? Understand? And that rotation is what ignites or takes advantage of the spinal engine. And so this is why someone who has a very spring-like quality to their fascia and to their movement patterns can run very efficiently. And someone who doesn't use that global spring is sort of plodding and likely to become injured when running. Now, the other reason can just be overuse or running with poor form. There's lots of reasons, but if you're plodding forward, plodding that is, with a great amount of effort and not much spring, the chances of injury are high. So when we're walking, we feel the heel just barely kiss the ground. We feel the outside edge of the foot engage in the surface of the earth. We feel the domed arch. We feel the slight rotation of the foot as we go from 5-4-3-2-1 across the metatarsals, and then a kiss of the ground with the first metatarsal, and a slight amount of dorsiflexion in the toe as you push off. And that dorsiflexion increases when you're running or walking more quickly or walking uphill. Dorsiflexion is when your toe pokes up like a dorsal fin of a shark. There's your mnemonic on remembering dorsiflexion versus plantar flexion. The rotational pattern that's present in walking travels throughout the entire body. In fact, walking gently pumps the lymph, and it even helps circulation of the cerebrospinal fluid because the head stays relatively still while the torso rotates underneath. So this means the cervical spine is rotating underneath the cranium. And this is what propagates the movement of the cerebrospinal fluid as we walk. This can happen in some riders while riding at certain intensities, no doubt. But most riders at lower intensities, which most of your time is spent riding at lower intensities, tend to have a more stoic posture. That's what's in vogue right now. And I'm as guilty of this as anyone. I spent years of my life trying to ride around like a perfect statue, expressionless, showing no pain, no emotion, no sense of strain or effort. Look, there's a certain aesthetic quality of cycling that you can fall in love with for riders who do this. I'm definitely going to unpack this in a future discussion. Sort of the archetypes of cycling, posturally and in terms of form. Maybe I'll call it form archetypes. For me, there are sort of three primary archetypes that I've identified at this point. One is the human spring. One is the human statue. And the other is Tommy Voeckler. So I won't give away too much more about that. I've got specific examples in mind. I've got examples of men in mind and some of the examples for women, but I want to solidify those examples so I can let people go forth and see what I mean and find the right videos to support the concepts that I'm talking about. And this is all for your learning benefit and mine too. That's the secret of this whole podcast. I get to learn from my own discussions, even the ones with myself. So we must walk. And I recommend walking every day if you can. Perfect world solution, 2 times a day. 10 to 30 minutes a day. Yes, this is on top of riding. Do you have time to do that? I don't know. I'm not the boss of your life. Do you want to do that? I don't know. I'm not here to tell you what your dream goal or objective is. But I am here to tell you what will make you a healthy human. And walking makes you a healthy human. Now, in support of this podcast, I'm hoping that I can secure a resource that one of my instructors recently talked about. It was a paper that demonstrated that the optimal amount of movement in a person's waking day is about 40% of the time. So let's think about that for a minute. Let's say that you get up at 7 a.m. and you go to bed at 10 p.m. So that's about 15 hours of waking time. Math. And about 9 hours of sleep. That's quite a bit of sleep. Is my math right? Yeah, I think that's right. So 15, 16 hours of waking time, something like that for most people. If you're getting a reasonable amount of sleep, 8 hours. there's an hour of fluff in there, we'll say. 40%, well, half of 15 hours would be 7 hours, 7.5 hours of movement. So 40% would be, you know, we'll call it 6 hours, maybe five, even 5 hours. Now, us as cyclists, we tend to think of our 5 hour days as long days. That would be a typical long bike ride for a lot of people. But we do that once or maybe twice a week if we're like a normal human with a job and a family. Now, if you're a pro, you're doing 5 hour days, maybe 2, 3, 4 times a week, depending on what time of year it is and whether you're at training camp or whatever. Okay. Still, what do you do in the other days? Maybe a couple hours of riding, maybe no riding, maybe a quick walk with your dog, or you're going to the grocery store, or you're going to the gym. And if it's the off season, you know, maybe there's more gym, or maybe there's some trail running or skiing or whatever you're doing. But the point is, it's nowhere close to 40% of your day. Now, if you're really 40% of the day active, most of that would probably be walking. And where do these numbers come from? Well, to be honest, I haven't had a chance to read this scientific paper yet, but I'm assuming they're looking retroactively at native peoples or aboriginal peoples or people who are undisturbed by devices like Teslas and Lazy Boys, dinner chairs, shit like this. So these people are sitting in deep squat. They're sitting in resting positions on the ground, meaning the long sit or seiza or samurai position or crisscross applesauce, otherwise known as cross-legged. And these positions can be considered a form of activity because they're active resting postures, which is sort of like fresh frozen or light yet filling. It's a little bit of a contradictory term, but the idea is you're sitting on the ground. And yes, you are passive, but you're also active in some sense because you're supporting your weight in a way that requires at least some fascial tension, if not muscular tension, or both. But then there's a lot of walking on top of that. Maybe there's gathering of groceries or hunting and gathering of food, doing things around the house, sweeping your doorstep, either literally or metaphorically. Maybe you're standing when you're on the phone. Maybe you're walking on a treadmill. Maybe you're walking through your neighborhood while you record a podcast. I can't say I was 40% active today, but I probably had a good amount of it. I went up the stairs, up and down the stairs quite a bit today. I was on my feet a good amount. Sometimes we have to deal with the realities of modern life. And sometimes those realities mean we can't be that active. But an active body is a healthy body. And this is based on one simple observation that I have made, which is really basic and really powerful. The further I go on this whole life learning journey, the more I figure out little clues like this that to me just seem like axiomatic truths. And this one is, what is closer to life? Movement or non-movement? What is more lifelike? More movement or less movement? This simple question illustrates a principle, a dichotomy, a polarization. So if I think about the things, or rather the creatures, that have the most life possible, the wiggliest creatures I can think of, what comes to mind for me is a puppy or small child. You ever walk past a playground at a grade school? The amount of energy and noise that comes off that playground while the kids are outside is insane. They're just running and screaming and yelling and swinging and throwing and dancing and jumping and doing everything all at once. That's the way a puppy is. Unless the thing is asleep, it's biting and wiggling and running and yipping and going in circles and shaking its butt and wagging its tail and flapping its ears and moving every muscle and every cell of its body all at once. the whole time it's awake. So puppies and kids are full of life. They are youthful. They've just been given life. They've just been granted life, and it's exploding out of their cells. Okay, now let's look at the opposite end of the spectrum. Just before someone dies, how much movement do they have? How much life force are they giving off? Well, not very much, because it's fading. The light bulb is going out. So someone who's in their deathbed barely moves. An old person can barely walk, right? Or chew, or poop, or breathe. Someone who's really old and really weak has trouble with these movements. They move less. So you see what I'm getting at. Movement is life. Ceasing movement is death. So the less you move, you could argue, the closer you are to death. Now, the opposite end of that theory is, well, Donald Trump. Fuck, I can't believe I'm talking about this guy on my podcast. This 8-year-old child. I'll stop. But he has this theory that humans are like batteries, and this is why he doesn't exercise, because he doesn't want to burn his battery out. Now, I'll just say it. This guy's a fucking idiot. But there is some truth to this from a certain perspective, in my understanding. What do I mean? Another more elegant way to say this is the flame that burns twice as bright burns for half as long, or something like that. There's a saying that basically says this. I kind of butchered it. And the point is, when you go too hard, you flame out. It's the same concept as when you start a time trial too fast. You run out of energy before the line. It's the exact same idea. So slow and steady wins the race. So when we're saying that you want to be active for 40% of your waking day, as a hypothetical, again, I haven't even had a chance to read this study yet, but as soon as my mentor, Matt Walden, said it, it struck me immediately as though it was evidently true. As soon as I had that moment of clarity, I began to think to myself, well, how can I bring more movement into my life? So what became evident to me is we must move, but we must move at a very sustainable rate, a low rate of exertion. And what is advantageous about this? It builds tone. It builds mitochondrial density. It burns fat. It improves aerobic metabolism. See, look at this. You just thought I was some weird hippie, but now I'm tying together all these bizarre concepts with key performance indicators. Ooh, look what I just did there. I made science words. So that must mean it's valid. It must mean that I'm smart, and it must mean that someone in a lab coat proved it. Okay, I'm being slightly skeptical, but these things are all accurate statements. Wow, that is an impressive pile of yard work someone has done. I'm looking at about 30 bags of leaves. Well played, sir. You have made good use of your yard cleanup. And so we consider this equation of 40% of movement a day or whatever. And we think about how many might do this. I try to stay very active in my day. I almost always ride my bike to work. It's not a very long ride, but it's better than no ride. And some days when I have time on the way home, I go the slightly long way and I run errands on my bike. And yeah, that comes at a price. Sometimes I show up a little sweaty to wherever I'm going. Sometimes I have a slight bit of anxiety that my bike's going to get stolen, because even with the world's most badass lock, these things happen, especially in Boulder. And, you know, there are other hazards of riding your bike around town. Things like hailstorms and traffic, homeless people, etc. But this is the city I live in, and these are the choices I make. And we live in an era of Gore-Tex. So, you know, how bad can it be? And if I'm really, really cold for a few minutes, then I'll warm up later. So I encourage you to consider adding walking to your daily routine, at least a few minutes here and there, it's good for your digestion post-dinner. It helps to stabilize blood sugar. You want to lose weight? Stabilize your blood sugar. Go for a walk after dinner. You want to lose weight, which a lot of people do. They like to lean out. I'll add one thing to your morning to-do list. Get up, put in some mouthwash, take a 3-minute cold shower. Keep the mouthwash in the entire time you're in the shower. This forces you to breathe through your nose only. We want the shower to be parasympathetic, not sympathetic. This person left their cab light on in their car. Do I open the door and turn it off at the risk of setting off their car alarm? I think not. Sorry, friend. I hope your car starts in the morning. When we come out of our parasympathetic shower, focused not on making ourselves badasses by jumping in an ice-cold river, but by using the cold as our teacher, in the words of Wim, then we go for a walk. Before the walk, consume our water and a little bit of salt, and then we take a stroll. Now you have activated the brown fat. You've kicked on the aerobic metabolism. You've activated the reticular activating system. That's the part of your brain that looks around peripherally for things like tigers or semi-trucks. But you've done it at walking speed in a familiar environment. Normally, you would do this walk from your home. So you're walking through a neighborhood, most likely. And neighborhoods tend to be pretty safe places in most parts of the world. Although I don't take that for granted. And now we can begin our day. And if you follow this routine, it'll be the best cup of coffee you ever had before you even had coffee. Because a cold shower and water and salt hydrates you and wakes you up and gives you a nice, happy little morning endorphin rush. You also start to turn off the melatonin from your sleepiness and give yourself a little morning cortisol rush, which is a great way to start your day and give yourself a productive jolt of morning energy. When we walk and we breathe through our nose, we can even begin to upregulate our CO2 tolerance. That's carbon monoxide. No, that's carbon dioxide. Hello. Di means two. And when we do this, some folks would say that we upregulate our ability to extract oxygen from the hemoglobin running through our blood cells. Now, that's the current level of teaching I have. I will say that with caution because I'm not a biochemical expert in oxygen kinetics, but that's what I got. If you want to know more, I recommend Patrick McGowan's book, The Oxygen Advantage. There he talks about the Bolt score, which you can play with on your morning or evening walks. To do this, you would walk and breathe normally, and then you would hold your breath on the exhale, that's on the out breath, or at the bottom of the breath, and count how many steps you make it before you achieve light air hunger. This is your Bolt score, or body oxygen level test. And as you become more CO2 tolerant, your Bolt score will go up. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that many cyclists and many athletes are a bit hyper-oxygenated and their CO2 tolerance is pretty crappy. So, food for thought. Check out Patrick's book if you're interested in learning more. And maybe you can begin to enhance your Bolt score and dig into what that means a little bit with a little bit more depth. So just some ideas on how to play with your evening walk. Tonight is a pretty spectacular evening. It's pretty warm out, although I'm getting a little nipped and the stars are especially sparkly. The last bit on walking is the connection with nature part. We get some air. We get full spectrum light on our skin and in our eyes in the morning, which is especially important. And in the evening, exposure to starlight also begins to wind us down for bed. The full moon can be a little disruptive to some people and some animals and even plants. The moon is kind of nature's way of screwing with us a little bit, just to tickle us every once in a while. But that only happens about once a month or so. So in the meantime, enjoy some starlight and enjoy a nice evening walk. Thanks for listening to me while I went on my evening walk. I hope this was maybe a little insightful or gave you some ideas on how to put a little more activity into your day and maybe give you a prod in the butt on whether or not to actually do it. Think critically, move consciously, and breathe with intention. Thanks for listening. Hello there, Cycling in Alignment listeners. I'd like to take a brief moment to speak to you about the podcast. As of this recording, I'm well over 125 episodes in, and this has been a multi-year project. And I'd like to say that I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have this podcast. And I mean, I suppose just about anybody could have a podcast now. But what I have is an opportunity to really educate people about the things that I've learned and have amazing discussions with so many guests on my pod. And I've got so many more episodes planned in the future. That said, this podcast is a challenge for me. It's a challenge to put it on, to find the time, and it requires financial investment. I've got to pay for an editor. I've got to pay for equipment. I'm paying for software. Paying for all the things you have to pay for when you put a podcast out into the world. And I have had financial supporters in the past. Enduro Bearings, namely, has been a great supporter. I've had other supporters as well. But moving forward, I'd like to offer a model in which my audience can show their appreciation directly. After a great amount of consideration and consternation on this topic, I've come to have a model in my mind. The model's really simple. If you have appreciation for the Cycling in Alignment podcast, if you have listened to my episodes and felt that it really has enriched your life, helped you, educated you, perhaps made you think about things from a different perspective, maybe you agreed with me on everything, maybe you agreed with me on just about nothing, but you listened anyway. I can't imagine that's the case, but I suppose it's possible. Maybe you agree with about 89% of what I say, and the other 11% of the time you think I am batshit crazy. In any case, if you would like to express your appreciation for the time, effort, and money that I put into this project, I would be grateful if you would go to my website, colbypierce.com, and click on the podcast page and offer some appreciation in the form of a financial contribution. This will help me offset the cost of this podcast. I may have other financial contributors in the future. This isn't a closed model by any means, but I do need to find a way to monetize this podcast. I've considered platforms like Patreon and others, but they seem convoluted and complicated. I don't really want to go to a paywall system. I really want to just offer content and teach, educate, discuss, philosophize. Have great dialogue with the guests that I'm honored to have on my show. And to do this in the simplest way possible, I just need to push play, push record, that is, and then you push play and get it out there. That's always been one of my methods of operation, is keep it as simple as possible and just produce the content. I don't have a goal of growing an audience. My goal is to educate people. And if I do that well, then my audience will grow as a side effect of that. So another way to offer your appreciation is to share my podcast with other people, to write reviews for me, do all the things, click the stars and make the comments. That helps because we live in a world of algorithmic preferential treatment. But if you want to move the dial for me, then please go to my website. That's colbypierce.com. Click on the page titled podcast, and there you will see some options to make a contribution that demonstrates your appreciation for what I've done. And for that, I will be grateful. There'll be a few different levels to this page, And the highest level will get you some goodies in as a thank you, including some Woolly Rafa t-shirts printed with my Pierce Coaching and Fitting logo. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you in advance for anything you can do to help me spread the word. If you aren't in a position to contribute financially or don't want to, again, you can help by simply forwarding my podcast, sharing it with other people, sharing it with your friends, tell people about it on rides, spread the word, and even just send me a message and let me know if I've moved the dial for you. Send me a message and let me know if you have pertinent questions. Also, at the highest level of the podcast contribution page, you will have the opportunity to submit a personalized question for detailed analysis on an episode or a private consultation, if that's what you prefer. So that's going to be something I can offer you in return for your financial contribution to my podcast. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I'm so grateful for my audience. I appreciate you and the opportunity you've given me. Epilogue. I want to share a few brief thoughts about the inception of Cycling in Alignment. The purpose of this podcast is for me to get 3.5 decades of hard-fought lessons out of my skull. Some of them through my own research and reading. Some of them I've been taught through mentors and colleagues, other riders, other racers. A lot of it, a massive amount of it, was simply trial and error through my own stubborn methods. And that has amassed a certain amount of experience and knowledge, understanding. And while I think I'm reasonably smart and I know quite a bit of stuff, I want to make it clear that the opinions that I share on this podcast are belief systems built on what I've experienced to this point. And that some of those opinions are pretty strong, but they are also loosely held. That is to say that if I learn more about a topic and have a greater level of clarity or understanding, then my old belief systems will be abandoned and I will now operate under that newfound knowledge. So I'm not here to tell people all the things that I know. I'm here to explain what I've learned to this point. And there's a big difference. Also, that is the intent when I discuss things on the pod with guests, is to learn from them and have a discourse. Because if we can't have a discourse as adults, then we've lost one of the basic tenets of modern society. Even if we disagree, we ought to be able to, in most cases, shake hands and walk away. Because after all, this is sport we're talking about, and while sport is training for life, it's nothing to get too upset over. The purpose of the podcast is to help me help other people, and specifically to help them actualize their highest potential by illuminating a path that enables alignment with their truth, their intent, and their coherence. That's really the end goal. So I'm grateful for your listening. My intent is also not, to be clear, to gain an audience or become popular or gain social status in any way. I don't care about that stuff. That said, if you feel an episode that you have heard will help someone you know, please share it with them. That helps us reach the end goal, which is to help more people. Thank you for listening. I'm grateful for your time and attention. Blessings.